States was warned long ago.
In the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence by the military-industrial complex. The potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists and will persist. We must never let the weight of this combination endanger our liberties or democratic process.
And then warned again, not long after.
The very word secrecy is repugnant in a free and open society. And we are, as a people, inherently and historically opposed to secret societies, to secret oaths, and to secret proceedings. And there is very grave danger that an announced need for increased security will be seized upon by those anxious to expand its meaning to the very limits of official censorship and concealment.
In fact, the U.S. is still warned to this very day. But are you listening?
What if the American people woke up and understood that the official reasons for going to war are almost always based on lies and promoted by war propaganda in order to serve special interests? What if we as a nation came to realize that the quest for empire eventually destroys all great nations? What if the American people learned the truth, that our foreign policy has nothing to do with national security, that it never changes from one administration to the next?
And this is Republic Theory with Dallas Andrews and Warren Dyson.
And welcome once again to another edition of Republic Theory on Jackalope 105 FM. I am Dallas Andrews, joined once again by my partner in crime, Warren Dyson. Warren, how are you?
I'm very good, and I am your partner in truth. Although some people seem to consider that a crime these days.
You know what? They do. A lot to cover on tonight's show. Quickly looking back at last week, we want to offer another thanks to Ted Muga of San Diegans for 9/11 Truth, and also Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. Warren, I think you would agree we got a pretty unique perspective from him.
A very powerful conversation we had with Ted, and it really, even as involved as we are with the truth movement and with the research that we've done, it's really important for us to have the perspective of an expert like him.
I couldn't agree more myself. And as hard as it might be to top Ted Muga, I think we might be giving him a run for his money tonight with our guest on this edition of Republic Theory. We are joined by, get this, a former NASA engineering executive. And let's go right to Dwayne Dietz. Dwayne, welcome to Republic Theory.
Thank you. Very, very glad to be here.
Well, it is a pleasure having you. Obviously, you can bring a wealth of perspective and expertise, if you will, to this discussion. If you would, to start with, elaborate on your background. You know, we referred to you as a former NASA engineering executive. That sounds pretty elaborate, so condense it for us, if you would.
I was at the NASA Center at Edwards Air Force Base. It's called Dryden Flight Research Center, for my career in aerospace, 37 plus years. And we worked in aeronautical flight research. We had basically tested new technology, either things that would go onboard airplanes, or we would test experimental airplanes. Also some space work, space shuttle. As the space shuttle gets back into the atmosphere and lands, we did research with that. So it was a very exciting career, and was able to see a lot of new things developed, one of which is what we refer to as remotely piloted aircraft, and it's sometimes called drones, and basically that whole technology, which possibly plays a role now as we look at the 9/11 situation.
And recap, if you you may have told me before, and I apologize if I forget, about how long were you with NASA?
I was with them for 37 years. Out of that 37, I spent 2 one-year tours about 10 years apart in Washington, D.C. So I got experienced in the Washington environment.
And how'd that go? What kind of environment did you find there?
Well, it's quite interesting to see the things that are important from the bigger picture, the federal government standpoint, and budgetary issues and political concerns, particularly from Congress and things like that. So I saw how those factors became important in formulating programs. I also was the executive secretary for a Blue Ribbon panel to give advice on what the NASA flight research program should be. So I basically learned how things happen at high-level panels, kind of from the inside.
I know that Warren has a couple of questions that he wants to get to. Before we get into that, I wanted to just kind of, as we continue our discussion on 9/11, on Republic Theory, I wanted to get your take on a personal level, maybe even more so than professional. When exactly did you start to have questions about the official story?
I think it was probably in about 2004. I became very puzzled by the airplane part of it, just from my professional background in aeronautics and flight controls was my specialty within that. I found it very difficult to see how hijackers could fly those airplanes as they apparently did. And so I just kind of started digging, trying to figure it out. And then kind of my interest got switched to the World Trade Center towers. Since I was focusing on the airplanes that struck the towers first as my area of interest, I then became kind of captivated by what seemed to be the evidence that the World Trade Center buildings themselves. And then I was very surprised to hear about Building 7. I hadn't really even known about that prior to that. That it come down the same day, and that just kind of attracted me to dig into it more and more and try to get straight in my own mind what must have happened.
Well, Dwayne, as an engineer and a physicist, I actually found this presentation that you had done. I found it on YouTube from October the 21st of this year at the Kroc Institute in San Diego. And I would recommend anybody who has a chance to go look up that YouTube piece. It's actually a very interesting piece. But in that piece, you break down for us these building collapses in what you refer to as the six pillars. And I was hoping that you could just kind of recap for us what those six pillars are in just a very basic format and just kind of give us a basis here to work from.
Okay, I tried to pick six areas that I thought each one standing on its own would be sufficient reason to have a new investigation. I had this feeling like the whole thing about controlled demolition was too complex and there was too many factors and things like this. So I just made an attempt to simplify it a little bit more for the general public. So I started from kind of the biggest concept, which I called symmetry, and I gave it the letter S for symmetry. And what this means is that we are told that there were forces that caused the building collapses, which I like to refer to as destructions, that it turns out these were asymmetrical forces in each of the three cases. Yet the buildings were destroyed in a very symmetrical fashion. So the laws of physics would say, no, you can't have an asymmetrical force cause a symmetrical outcome. So that's the S for symmetry. The next pillar is looking at the huge structural members, and I call it massive members, on the twin towers that were thrown laterally hundreds of feet all around the buildings. And the fact that they were thrown laterally, it meant that there was a lateral component of a velocity that was not provided by gravity. So it was not a gravitational collapse. It had to have been forced out horizontally to begin a ballistic path down to the ground. And these were 10 to 20 ton structural members that their initial velocity away from the building was 50 miles per hour, which would be 80 kilometers per hour. And so that would be a massive force wave that must have started them on their path laterally. And they ended up like 600 feet away from the building, which is 2 football field lengths away from the building. So that, from a physics standpoint, just told me it couldn't have been gravity that caused these massive members to be thrown like that. The third pillar I called removal of structure. And this really follows from recognizing that there was free fall acceleration, and it's particularly notable on Building 7, where the top part of the building suddenly fell in a free fall that lasted for a little over 100 feet, which corresponds to 8 stories. And this means that those 8 stories somewhere below, we can't see them because they're blocked from view of other buildings, but 8 stories of structure at lower levels had to suddenly get out of the way. And that means someone had to have made provisions to have that structure removed suddenly and abruptly. The fourth pillar I refer to as the iron pillar, iron and other byproducts of what turns out to be thermite. So iron is the element that was most notable. There was large quantities either as molten iron or as kind of in a microscopic way, looking at iron-rich microspheres, which we can talk about later. So it was the amount of iron that was in the remains, the debris of the building, that points back to thermite. There was quite a few other elements as well that were found, and the distribution between these elements would be the same distribution that you would see if you were looking at thermite or thermate, both kinds of incendiaries. And therefore, it kind of infers that there was these sometimes I refer to them explosives, but maybe an accelerant is a better word to describe them. And then the fifth pillar, which I give the letter C, and I picked that because of the very large temperature difference between what the official story explains that would be due to aviation fuel fires and office contents, that level of temperature versus evidence that there was temperature as high as 1,000 degrees centigrade higher than that. I call this a centigrade tsunami because it was like a massive overflow of temperature that lasted for weeks later. It just seems to be unexplainable. Certainly, if you only take the official story explanations, it's not explainable. There is an explanation of what probably caused that, and that would go to the sixth pillar, which is E for explosives. And in this case, it's looking at what was found later in the dust, although a lot of times I think of it as in the powder that was the result of the pulverization of the building materials, so the concrete and everything that went into it. And out of that was found to be some unignited military-grade explosives, which is called nanothermite. So that kind of then gives an explanation on why these temperatures could be as high as they apparently were. So I think if any of those six topics, or pillars, if you will, if any one of them seems like the evidence is showing something considerably different than what the official explanation has been, then you ought to stop right there and say there needs to be a new investigation. You shouldn't have to wait until you hear about the other areas as well.
We're visiting with Duane Dietz, former NASA engineering executive, on this week's edition of Republic Theory on Jackalope 105 FM. Duane, I wanted to back up, I believe it was to Pillar 1, and discuss the symmetry aspect of the damage, because I've tried to offer this, I guess, analogy or visual. I guess it's more of a visual, because you mentioned the asymmetrical damage sustained by both of the twin towers, and that obviously means that the damage was not even. They're you know, square buildings essentially, so one side didn't receive the same damage as the other. Provided that we did have the temperatures necessary to melt or even soften steel, as some keep falling back on, enough to create some kind of catastrophe, wouldn't it have been more reasonable to see, in the instance of World Trade Center Tower 1, maybe the top half of the building maybe lean over and break off or something to that effect?
Yes, in fact, I would say that would be true for both Tower 1 and Tower 2. Tower 1, let me just talk about the difference in the airplane strikes for the two towers. On Tower 2, which was the second airplane to strike, the airplane angled through kind of open office space and out the other side and missed most of the core columns. In fact, it might have missed them all, I'm not sure. So if there was any melting of structure, it wouldn't have been any primary core column structure. It would have been off to the side somewhere, and it would be very asymmetrical, just kind of over on the side. So for that to immediately lead to a symmetrical severing of a whole floor and therefore a symmetrical free fall into the path of greatest resistance below it, it's against the law of physics. If you go to Tower 1, the first airplane to strike, it was not this glancing path through office areas, but rather it was directly into the core columns. Well, it went through a little bit of office space, but it went into the core columns head on. And so that's a very different pattern of damage in that tower. Yet the two towers came down symmetrically. You can hardly tell the difference, with the exception of the initial damage to Tower 2, which was a lower airplane strike, was to have the top of the building tilt over to the side. And so that was asymmetrical tilt, but it then kind of destroyed itself before it continued falling. So it went from being kind of an asymmetrical tilt to be in a totally symmetrical destruction the rest of the way down.
Duane, I wanted to revisit something here on Pillar 4 when it has to do with the iron and the other thermite byproducts that you mentioned, fluorine, aluminum, manganese, things like that. I've had a lot of challenges, well, not a lot, but a few challenges, as far as people saying that these small, molten iron spheres, that type of thing, could have been a byproduct of the cleanup process when they're using torches to cut the beams and that kind of thing. Now, from your perspective, what is it about these little spheroids that makes them absolutely not able to be a byproduct of the cleanup process?
Well, the strongest reason is that one of the samples of dust was collected 10 minutes after the tower nearby went down, which was before any cleanup operations began. And the four samples of dust, and they were collected from different parts of Manhattan, were very consistent with each other. So we have kind of a timestamp within 10 minutes of the building coming down that is consistent with other dust. So that by itself rules out any cleanup operations as contributing here.
And I did want to ask, what can you tell us about NIST? This organization now throughout the course of the show, we've referenced NIST, we've talked about the NIST reports, but honestly, I believe we haven't done necessarily a service to our listeners by explaining what NIST is. Could you advise us what makes up NIST?
Okay, NIST stands for National Institute for Standards and Technology. It's a government laboratory within the Department of Commerce. It used to be called the Bureau of Standards, but they changed their name somewhere along the line. And they were given a charter in 2002, October of 2002, the charter to study the buildings. And it was written, and this is by the Congress and signed by the President. So their commission or charter to study these buildings and determine what should be done in the way of improving safety. That was kind of the emphasis of that charter. And a lot of what they came out with is recommendations for improved building codes that would enhance safety. But all of their study really was trying to understand what went on, supposedly. On the one that really dragged out was their study of Building 7. And it wasn't until August of 2008, that they finally came out with what they called their final draft report. And then they called for public comments at that time, and then issued their final report in November of 2008, about a week or so after the general election. They had come out with earlier reports, draft reports, and their final report on the Twin Towers was, I can't remember the exact year, probably 2005. And they only went to the initiation of collapse. So they really didn't analyze at all any of how the building came down itself. They basically stopped short of all of that.
In the NIST report about World Trade Center 7's collapse, I had heard that they had essentially admitted to the free fall speed timings that a lot of us have been aware of, and that they kind of confirmed that in their report. But I'm afraid I didn't ever find out how they explained away the timings being accurate for a free fall, and yet not explaining away that total removal of structure that you were talking about that would be necessary to achieve that type of thing. In your investigations into the NIST report, have you seen where they were able to successfully explain that away?
Well, no, I don't think that they did explain it. What happened is they were claiming up through their August of 2008 draft report that the building came down 40% slower than free fall. So they made quite a change between August and November, where they in November said it was pure free fall for little over 2 seconds. And what they explained is that there were three phases to the collapse. The first phase, or stage, I guess used word stage, the first stage was something starting to move, and they picked some initial point, which is basically, we're not sure what they were looking at when they started the clock and count and started from zero. And then they got to stage two, and that was what they said was free fall. And then they had stage three, which was the remaining time. What they ended up doing then, and this is in November, final report, they looked at that total time between the start of stage one and the end of stage three, and they said that total time, which I think was 5.4 seconds, 5.6, can't remember, that was the same time as their analysis, their computer models had shown. And they therefore concluded that that was in good agreement. But what we know of their computer models is they did not include any mechanism that would explain the free fall part of it. So they basically ended up kind of glossing over it and saying, aha, we have good agreement. We have the same total length of time, and it agrees with our analysis. And they just kind of one final sentence saying, it was in agreement with their analysis, so they didn't change their analysis. The analysis stood by what they had all along. They just made this, what they consider to be a minor adjustment, and broke it into three stages. I will say one additional thing is they made it very difficult to find this admitting of free fall. It was not mentioned in their list of changes that they made between their draft report and their final report, and which is a big thing. It means that if anyone was just going to look at what happened in the report and looked at the summary statements, they wouldn't see this very significant change. And secondly, they did not change any of their basic assumptions of what happened. They basically said their original analysis was still good.
You mentioned NIST's computer modeling of the Twin Towers, where they modeled it up to the point of collapse, and their modeling of World Trade Center 7's collapse. But has NIST ever released any of that data to a point where it could be, say, peer-reviewed?
No. In fact, I'll just focus on Building 7, since that's the one that they apparently did the more complete modeling. They spent many years working on that. They have not provided that. They didn't provide the details in their final report. There have been Freedom of Information Act, referred to as FOIA, requests for the model and the input parameters that went into their model, and they have not responded to the FOIA requests. However, they did respond by saying it will cost $800 and some odd for us to provide this data to you. And so Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth sponsored a call, something they call a chip-in, for people to donate money to try to raise this $800 and some odd. And so that money was raised, and a check was written to NIST, and NIST has done nothing with it. So NIST is not being cooperative at all in providing this information.
Dwayne, I did want to touch on something here, and I'm just going to be honest with you up front. This is probably going to enter the world of speculation. So if you don't want to speculate a whole lot on this, I completely understand. A lot of your background, again, as you said, was in aeronautics for NASA. I know you were involved in the HIMAP program, which I was a huge fan of when I was a kid. I wanted to be a pilot. I was always amazed by these remote aircraft, the HIMAP, the highly maneuverable testbed airframe. I was a big fan of that type of engineering, and I was really excited when I found out that you were involved in it, just to have a chance to talk to you a little bit about it. But as far as, again, branching to speculation here, do you believe that it is plausible or possible that remote aircraft could have been involved in these attacks one way or another, whether it was remote 767s, whether it was another type of aircraft? Do you think that's a possibility?
Well, the HIMAT was maybe my first experience with remotely piloted airplanes. The HIMAT was a 3/8 scale model of a hypothetical full-scale fighter. The idea was we could build a smaller vehicle a lot less expensively than to build a full-scale one. And we were looking at combined technologies on this advanced fighter, aeroelastic wings so that the wing would bend and give you the proper shape under high levels of G and things like that. I won't go into all of the technologies, but we used remotely piloting technology as a means of doing demonstrations of other advanced technologies. It just allowed us to do the whole thing cheaper. We launched the airplane from a B-52, so we dropped it from under the wing of the B-52, and then it flew its mission. Since that time, a number of other remotely piloted aircraft activities, projects, were done, one of which is very closely related to this, and that was taking a transport airplane, and the test objective was looking at some additives to the fuel that would cause it to be fire retardant. And so we took this transport airplane and crashed it into a big metal device on the dry lake bed and basically caused what should have been a fire to the engines and whatnot as it crashed in. And the idea was that the plane would not catch on fire because of this additive. Well, it turned out, well, first of all, we were able to carry out that test very well, where we flew the airplane exactly where we wanted to. The pilot was in a ground-based cockpit, just flying it through his instruments and a TV camera looking out through the window that he then had the display of that. So that part of the technology was well in hand. We knew how to do that. Our test was only looking at whether the fuel additive worked correctly. Turned out it didn't work correctly. It burst into big flame, so it showed that the additive did not work. Now, that actually saved a lot of money to the public because the additive was then not a requirement for aviation to start adding. If they had to add it, it would have cost more money to fly. And so we showed that it didn't work. And so that's just another one. And there are other examples of remotely piloted and on into drone aircraft. So I think your question was, do I think that technology could have been applied at the World Trade Center and other flights as well on 9/11/01? And I think the answer is yes. And as I look at some of those flight maneuvers, it just seems to me that a remotely piloted airplane would be the most logical way to do that kind of thing. Of course, this is speculation. There's no way of proving that. But it certainly was a technology that was available and had been used in quite a few different special situations, special tests, and therefore it would be available to use on that day as well.
So obviously the suggestion of remote-controlled airplanes isn't some, you know, lost in space kind of idea, because and Dwayne, you may run into this sometimes, but you suggest that to people, and you may or may not be surprised. I'm sure that you're not, but it does surprise me in some cases how many people don't even know that technology exists.
That's quite true. It was maybe the people that were really into those flight tests knew about it, and maybe it was a interesting story in the newspaper for a day or two, and then it kind of gets lost. So the general public doesn't really realize that that's available. Now, I would expect that if it's used, it would be used on a test aircraft of some sort. The idea of having it being used in a commercial transport with people on it, that to me is more far-fetched. So I become someone who would expect that if someone wanted to use remotely piloted technology, they probably would take an airplane and outfit it with the necessary equipment and do it that way. So I have a difficulty taking that next step that says, therefore, because we've been told that it involved these commercial transports with passengers on board, it must have been done. I have doubts that additional step was part of the overall scheme. So, but that really gets into speculation. If it wasn't as we've been told, then what was it? I have no answer to that. All I can say is I don't know. We don't know. And let it go at that.
Dwayne, we just had a very good question arrive via email, and I think that you have roughly 7 or 8 buildings that exist in the world today that rival or surpass that of the World Trade Centers at, what were they, around 1,100 feet, I guess, or 1,000 feet or higher. The biggest, I believe, being a newer structure in Dubai. With respect to World Trade Center 7, or with the Twin Towers, rather, compared to World Trade Center 7, you have very different events going on as far as the collapse itself. And just to simplify, with World Trade Center 7, you literally see the building seem to sink into the ground, just free fall, obviously implosion. But with the World Trade Centers, you have this tremendous explosive event happening, you know, from one point of the building way up high all the way down. And the question specifically is there any frame of reference whatsoever regarding the demolition of buildings as tall as the World Trade Centers?
Well, there is no demolition for buildings that tall. I don't know for sure that, but I absolutely do not know of such an event. And so part of it is it's a different kind of a challenge for controlled demolition experts to bring down a building of that height, and possibly because of its construction, it had these primary core columns. It had 47 control columns in the center part of the building, which bore most of the structural weight. The perimeter columns bore enough weight to hold up the floors. They're part of it, but it really was those central core columns that was the primary structure and had all the elevators within the sets of core columns. That means that the demolition design would have to be taking out those core columns and pretty much all the way from the top to the bottom. And the fact that when it was all destroyed, there were no columns still standing. So that means they had to be removed, and removed at various places throughout the height of the building.
Is it your understanding that that the World Trade Centers were in need of quite a bit of work? I've heard as much as $1 billion worth of either renovations or improvements, asbestos removal, things of that nature. It might fall into the neighborhood of speculation, but I'm sure you're aware of Larry Silverstein and the money he made off of this and his recent acquisition of the complex just a matter of weeks or months before the events took place. And have you heard that as well, that they were kind of viewed as these big white elephants in Manhattan?
I've heard that as well. I can't confirm any of that because it seems like there's not solid reporting that you can go to. I may be wrong, but I have heard that. I've heard that the asbestos was a major problem, and it would be on the order of $1 billion just to remove the asbestos. So it was a major problem. Again, that's to the best of my knowledge.
Once again, visiting with former NASA engineering executive Dwayne Dietz on this edition of Republic Theory. It is great to have you along. I'm Dallas Andrews along with Warren Dyson. We're discussing the events of September 11 and really honing in on Manhattan, as obviously we all remember what we were doing on that day. It's one of those things that you never truly forget. But I know I can speak for all three of us at this time, until you go back and look after the fact, you might find some unusual things about both the events themselves as well as the explanations, and specifically with respect to perhaps what did not happen. Dwayne, I wanted to ask where you were that day, if you don't mind just elaborating on a personal level. What were you doing on September 11, and what led you to the TV or the radio that day?
It's kind of an interesting story. My wife and I were heading to the airport in Los Angeles, LAX, and we were going to fly to Boston that day. And we were listening to a book on tape in the car as we drove to the airport. It happened to be a book that was on the theme of terrorists attacking areas. And so we were completely absorbed in that. And then we got to the airport area, so I turned off the book on tape and turned on the airport news, and basically just to see about parking and traffic, and heard the report of the buildings being struck. And it just seemed surreal. It seemed like this is an extension of the book on tape I'd just been listening to. So we listened a little bit, and we said to each other, "Is this real? Are we listening to the real world here?" And we concluded that, yeah, it was in fact real. So we just decided, well, we're not going anywhere today. They probably won't even let us to the airport. So we just pulled over to a restaurant and had breakfast while we tried to get information, and there happened to be a TV in the restaurant, so we learned about it in that way.
What were your initial thoughts about what was going on?
Well, I just absolutely did not understand how the buildings could collapse, and that was when they said, yes, the first one's collapsed, and then we heard that the second one. I could not believe that that was a result of airplane strikes, but I kind of took my disbelief and set it aside and didn't pursue it. I just got in a mode of immediate kind of accepting what the explanations were. So I was not suspicious as I wished I would have been, more so.
And I think that's a real important point to bring out is most of September 11, or if you want to just call it the truth movement, which is kind of a catchy new term that's developed in the last couple of years, as I kind of took a hiatus, to be honest. You have the accusations constantly being thrown about regarding conspiracy theorists. And frankly, I mean, I have some ideas as to what I think happened, but a conspiracy theory is exactly that. It's the idea that a group of people conspired to do something together, something often violent or political. But the theory part is where you're, and correct me if I'm wrong, a theory is based on absolutely nothing. And in this case, we have volumes of circumstances that kind of shatter the theory part, do we not?
I think that's true. This whole area, one of the responses that I've started making use of is if someone questions me about what I'm talking about as conspiracy theory stuff, I basically say, well, everyone is a conspiracy theorist. It's just that the majority of people have picked the official theory as the conspiracy that they believe in, because it's obviously a conspiracy. In other words, there were multiple people that carried that off, whether they were terrorists out of Afghanistan or some other groups. It had to have been a conspiracy, and so everyone believes that it was a conspiracy of some sort. It's just that people only use that word applied to those who don't subscribe to the majority view.
And I think we can probably point towards our mainstream press or media, if you want to call it that, for much of that, because it's really true. I mean, is it not your opinion that we've been, at least the attempt has been made and is made to this very day to condition the public as far as what they think, not so much about 9/11, but about people who question what the government tells me or which soft drink you like best?
Yeah, I'm more and more seeing that that is true. It becomes more and more depressing to see it, but yes, I see that as a pattern that persists.
So talk about some of your work with AE 9/11 Truth, or the Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. As Warren mentioned earlier, might not have been on the air yet, but we had Ted Muga on the show last week, and I understand he has extensive involvement with the group. Give us your take on things there.
Well, I'm very heavily involved. I'm the head of what they call the writing team. The writing team, one thing it does is it puts out a monthly newsletter, e-newsletter, so it's web-based. We also attempt to get letters into general publications. So we have a number of volunteers who are writers, and I'm responsible for getting our team working efficiently and getting the articles into use. I'm also a member of the board of directors for the organization, so I'm involved from that standpoint. And I'm also starting to do presentations. I think we mentioned about the six pillars. So that is another arm of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth, is trying to develop more speakers to be out presenting the material and not just have Richard Gage, who is the founder, an architect from the Bay Area, San Francisco Bay Area, of 20 years, a member of American Institute of Architects. So he's been the primary person that's been out making these presentations, over 100 now, and we're trying to get more and more people also speaking, and so I'm one of those as well.
As we talk about the possibility for a new and independent investigation, which I think I told you a couple days ago, I hate to be negative, but I don't believe that power investigates itself, or at least it tries as hard as hell, you know, not to. Do you find it odd, and I'm assuming the answer is yes, but I'm hoping you'll elaborate somewhat. In a typical murder investigation, the homicide team will jump on the case as soon as they know there's a body. And we've all heard of, or perhaps watched the TV shows, the first 48 hours, and just with all the crime shows that have exploded on network television and even on cable, real or scripted, in the last decade, many of us have become a lot more, maybe perhaps too familiar with the process. But those first 48 hours are extremely critical following any kind of a murder or mass murder, which we obviously had on September 11th. And yet, I find it curious that even the 9/11 quote-unquote commission, whether you want to call it an investigation or not, didn't start for 440 days after the fact.
That's true, and they wouldn't have even started then if there hadn't been just major pressure put on the political power people to get that investigation up and running. The pressure was by the family, by certain family members of the Jersey Girls in particular, but that was just persistence to keep pressing and pressing and pressing, and finally there seemed to be no other alternative than to have the investigation. And without that, it could be that we wouldn't even have a single investigation at this point in time. That, I don't know whether that would have been good or bad, because the investigation itself certainly didn't come up with very much.
And I think some people really, really have trouble digesting that feeling as though, even if you go back to JFK, and I'll be quite frank, I would bet my last dollar that Lee Harvey Oswald did not fire the fatal shot that hit JFK. And so here's another, well, it's a murder one way or the other, and yet we don't seem to have much of an investigation, but we have one of these commissions. And I find that interesting that you could have an event on September 11th like we did 2001 and possibly, as you just said, not even have an investigation at all, because I do recall the Bush administration doing everything they could to stonewall an actual investigation, and not knowing that over the course of time, you still have so many people that feel like the work that NIST did and the documentaries they've seen on the History Channel and on Nat Geo are perfectly acceptable and official, and there's no problem. And how do you respond to that in a nutshell?
Well, I've been making some efforts to maybe confront is the right word, members of the establishment. And I went to see a physics professor recently at my alma mater, which is a small college in Los Angeles area. So since I was a physics major, I felt I could go see a physics professor at the college and present them some of this material on, particularly I chose Building 7 to make the case. And the response was that I got from this individual was, first of all, he said he didn't have the expertise to evaluate this. And I kind of responded back, well, I've only picked the part that is kind of general classical physics. And it seems like you ought to be able to evaluate that, and I'm only asking you to decide whether there ought to be a new investigation. I'm not really asking you to dig into it. But then his next response was just an assumption that NIST would have investigated it thoroughly. And so he says, well, I really can't do that until I completely read the entire NIST report on this. So he still had that basic belief that NIST must have evaluated properly. And finally, when I got to the chart that showed the Building 7 going into freefall, and that the structure had to, the eight stories at the bottom had to have been abruptly removed, he just looked at that and he says, well, why wouldn't NIST have explosives as one of their possibilities? So he was just totally puzzled by that. He came up with the word explosives. I didn't. Yet, he could not back away from his feeling like he didn't have the expertise. I'm not sure whether that was his feeling or whether that was his position, where he just didn't want to get into this subject any further than that. And that's the way we left it.
And hopefully, as the effort that you're putting forth, myself along with Warren and countless others that continue to wake up to this every day, can start to change that culture where if you're not conditioned not to question the government, that in fact you might even be afraid. Because I'm convinced regarding that, because you told me this story a few days ago when we spoke on the phone the first time, that sounds like career preservation to me. And you don't have to elaborate on that if you choose not to, but we've seen this elsewhere, and changing the culture I think is something that must be done. Because as I told you, Dwayne, I don't know that we'll see a new and investigation. I hope that we do. I support that, you know, through and through. But I think that one of the most important things that that I want to do, that I think we can do, is prevent the next false flag operation in this United States. That I don't know that it's coming, but I just don't get the feeling that 9/11 was really the last that we'll see, given the aftermath, the wars, the Patriot Act, and so forth. And I think that's, would you agree that at least preventing the next one without a war overseas in a couple of third world countries is critical for us?
Yes. In fact, I think that's my primary motivation for continuing to pursue this, is I think we, we collectively, the truth researchers, however you want to characterize the group, we need to be able to send the message to whoever planned and carried this out that they can't get away with that anymore, that it won't work next time. And even if there isn't a new investigation, if there's enough of a widespread, let's say, subscribing to that view among the public, if it becomes more than a majority, if polls show that 60-70% have this view, even without a new investigation, I think that would end up sending the message that they didn't get away with it. But of course, I also would like to see some of our politicians have the courage to speak out and saying this needs to be handled properly. And in that case, it would be a new investigation. Right now, we don't have that. We don't have any politicians on either the congressional side or the administration side that will publicly make those kind of statements.
Dwayne, we could talk to you for another 3 hours, I'm sure, maybe even till dawn, but our time is up. I sincerely hope you'll come back and see us again sometime.
Well, I would like to do that. I'm sure there'll be new developments and things to discuss at that time.
Well, again, thank you very much for coming and spending an hour with us. And we will definitely be in touch with you. And anything we can do to help, you be sure and let us know as well.
Very good. Okay, I enjoyed it.
As did we. That's Dwayne Dietz, former NASA engineering executive, on this edition of Republic Theory.
Thank you, Dwayne. It's a pleasure talking to you. And Dallas, I did want to correct, or not correct, but add one thing. I do remember during our pre-interview prep, Dwayne had mentioned that if that type of remote HIMAT type technology had been used, he said he did not believe that it was a manually piloted type of thing, that it would have been something more GPS or a pre-programmed automated type of device. And I just want to add that on there because I don't believe he got a chance to mention it in there, and it is a very important clarification to make.
And also, I would add that I don't believe that if we still had him on the line or had more time, we could clarify. But I know that Dwayne nor anyone else is not claiming that this was used. But when you add everything together about that day, and I'll go ahead and include the fact that there's just no airplane in Shanksville. There's not even a hint of an airplane in Shanksville. There's barely hints of airplanes at the Pentagon. So now we've cut the entire story in half. We started with four airplanes. But in fact, we only have two. And so then you start looking in deeper and deeper and deeper. And once you know that there's one small lie, one medium-sized lie, that often leads you to a much greater deception. And, you take someone like Mr. Dietz as well as eyewitness testimony. They didn't appear to be normal airplanes. But I think the point being, and it's duly noted, that the technology was easily there to remote control these planes. I'm assuming he meant kind of like a pre-programmed GPS type thing.
Yeah, the type of technology that I would assume, well, you just take a Tomahawk cruise missile, for example. It's a pre-programmed GPS-driven type device. But this is one of the things I kind of dislike. I don't like to get into a lot of speculation, but we can deal in what we know. And I do appreciate Dwayne's forbearance in speculating just a little bit there, but I don't want to get too deep into it. But we can focus on what we know. And what we know is the buildings were brought down intentionally, and we know what we know about the Shanksville and the Pentagon.
Yes, we do. And as you look deeper into this, if you're just catching on to the show, we've spent the last several shows, our first several shows, dealing with the events of September 11th, 2001. Both Warren and myself have had problems with the official story for a number of years now, and we aren't the only ones. So it's our not only our pleasure, but our duty to bring you, the listener, no matter what political party you happen to subscribe to, no matter what you actually think about that day. It's our duty to bring forth the information that we have gathered, the perspective that we have gathered, because contrary to some that we may have on the show here pretty soon, we are not crazy people, are we?
Not the last time I was checked out by my psychologist.
Of course, we may need to go for a visit, but that's neither here nor there. It's been a pleasure. Thank you once again to Dwayne Dietz, former NASA engineering executive, who has given us some great perspective tonight. And we will see you next time on Republic Theory on Jackalope 105 FM.